The Bob Murphy Show, episode 47.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. Today I'm going to be talking with Dr. Benjamin Powell. Ben is the director of the Free Market Institute, which is at Texas Tech University, and he's a professor of economics in the Jerry S. Rawls College of Business Administration at Texas Tech. Ben is also the North American editor of the Review of Austrian Economics. He's been a past president of what's called the Association of Private Enterprise Education, or API, and he's also a senior fellow with the Independent Institute. Ben earned his BS in economics and finance from the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and his MA and PhD in economics from George Mason University. And before he went to Texas Tech, Ben taught economics at Suffolk University and also at San Jose State University. So what we're going to be talking about today in this interview primarily is Ben's new book that comes out today as this podcast is being released, that he co-authored with Robert Lawson, and the book is titled provocatively, Socialism Sucks. So I'm sure many of you listeners will agree with that thesis, and we'll have Ben explain the origin of the book, and it's a fun conversation. So let me just also mention that I am personal friends with Ben. I've known him for a while, going back to, I think we met at a Mises Institute event, and we were going through grad school. I was at NYU, he was at GMU. We were similar in age and grade, if you use that term. And I also worked with Ben. He had me go to the Free Market Institute. I spent several years there, and I just recently wrapped up my stint there because, as I mentioned last podcast episode, for those who haven't heard through the grapevine, I got married and so moved away from Texas and hence couldn't work there anymore. But it's a great place. We also talk a little bit about that in the beginning. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Ben Powell. Well, hello, Ben. Welcome to the Bob Murphy Show.
Hey, Bob. Good to be with you, buddy.
So as I mentioned in the formal introduction there that the listeners just heard, one of your many hats is that you're the head of the what's called the Free Market Institute at Texas Tech. So I think a lot of people know about that. I'm no longer there, but I was there for several happy years. Can you explain for the listeners what is this FMI?
Sure, and loved having you there with us, Bob, while it worked for us. So the Free Market Institute was founded 6.5 years ago to promote study and teaching related to free market economics. It's a university-wide institute. We've got between 15 and 20 people working with us at any one time now, professors, postdocs, PhD students, and staff. For one thing that might be relevant for some of your younger listeners, some college students, is we give out graduate fellowships to come study if you're interested in earning a PhD in economics or political science or other related discipline at Texas Tech, where you can work with some stellar free market faculty with a variety of specializations, including some Austrian economists there and a variety of other schools as well.
Yeah, and I should mention, too, that the speaking circuit that you've got traveling through there is pretty impressive, especially for people who are into anarcho-capitalism. There was, you had what PJ Hill went through, David Friedman, Pete Leeson. It was pretty impressive.
Bruce Benson, Tom Woods. We've had a whole cast of characters come through.
Tom who?
Yeah, that guy. I think he lost a debate to you recently.
Yes. Yeah. So, and all joking aside, yeah, it really was impressive of the opportunity that those students got. If you're, of course, interested in decentralized private law systems, things like that, and just Austrian economics in general.
Yeah, great place, and you can learn more about it at our website, which is just fmi.ttu.edu, and you can look through and see all these different speakers that Bob's mentioning there, along with my colleagues who work there all the time that you have an opportunity to work with. It's a fun place to be.
Yep, and I'll put all these links to it, bobmurphyshow.com/47 if you miss any of the references we give you. Well, Ben, before we dive into your book, can you just give us a brief, because I think a lot of my listeners have heard of you before. I know Tom and I on Contra Krugman mention your work a lot. So can you just get what I like to do when I have somebody that the listeners may have heard of before, just briefly, how did you get into this wacky world of Austrian economics and libertarianism?
Gosh, kind of by accident, really. While I was an undergraduate, I went to University of Massachusetts at Lowell. I didn't have any kind of Austrian faculty or free market faculty or anything like that there. And just on my own, stumbled into the writings, first of Milton Friedman, but then found Hayek, then found Mises and Rothbard, and found my way to a summer seminar. I think I met you, Bob, at maybe the second one I attended, and got hooked on these type of ideas, and then looked for a graduate school where I could study them more in depth, and I've been doing it ever since.
So were you an economics major, though, when you first stumbled on this stuff, or is this what made you become an economics major?
Well, I fell in love with economics all by itself. I started as an accounting major who found finance more interesting, who added econ as a minor. It became a second major, and somewhere in the course of that, the path down these books started happening, too.
Okay. What was it? Do you remember, like, why didn't you just end up being a fan of the Chicago school, for example? Like, what was it about the Austrian school?
Gosh, I don't know if I can remember a specific thing when I was an undergraduate, other than the more I read of them, the more it made sense to me. It seemed to better explain the world than some of my professors who weren't Chicago school. They'd be more Keynesian or interventionist that I had probably as undergraduates. But even there, I mean, just the logic of economics, of mainstream economics, I think does so much for helping to understand the world that that was what drew me to the topic overall.
Yeah, I had a similar thing because someone asked me recently, I think it was just when I was at Mises U, they were asking me and I was admitting, I said, actually, I read Milton Friedman before I read Mises. I had read his Money Mischief for sure. And I can't remember if I got his, you know, more pop ones. And so I couldn't remember. It's kind of like with you. I couldn't remember specifically what was it. It was just, yeah, reading Henry Hazlitt and then Rothbard and Mises, like they made the most sense to me in terms of putting everything together where, you know, I had liked Friedman's stuff, but it seemed like this stuff was flowed better or whatnot.
Yeah, I can remember probably as a sophomore or junior, I think a page out of Capitalism and Freedom that lists, I don't know, a dozen things the government does that it has no business doing. I can remember posting that on my bulletin board at a little cubicle I had at school. And but then by the time I got out of undergraduate, I was at Murray Rothbard for New Liberty and learning about how police and courts can be privately provided. And I was like, wow, this is way more radical and interesting.
Yeah, that's pretty extreme for an accounting major.
X accounting.
Okay, gotcha.
We got rid of that by sophomore year.
Okay. Well, today is actually, as this episode is being released, is coinciding with the release publicly of your latest book. You have a co-author as well. So why don't you just tell us about that?
Sure. The new book is totally different than anything I've done before. It's called Socialism Sucks, Two Economists Drink Their Way Through the Unfree World. I did it with Robert Lawson, who's the well-known co-author of The Economic Freedom of the World Annual Report. And this is a very popular style book. The publisher originally described it as the bastard stepchild of Anthony Bourdain and Milton Friedman, because the style is like Bourdain and a bit off color, but replace food with economic systems, particularly socialism versus capitalism, and his culinary critiques with economics and history of socialism and capitalism, and but done in a firsthand travel story. And that's the overall genre kind of the book.
And so obviously we're going to get into the content of it, but can you just explain a little bit the backdrop? Like, was it one thing that you guys were going to do and then it just blossomed and you said, let's do a book? Or like from the get-go, did you know we're doing a book and this is why we got to start buying plane tickets?
Well, from the get-go, yeah. Bob was pushing me to go to Cuba with him, and I wanted to figure out a way to write it off my taxes.
Let me just stop you real quick. So just folks, when Ben's referring to Bob here, he's talking about Bob Lawson, the co-author, not me.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I'll try to refer to him as Lawson if I can
okay.
keep it in mind on this show. So Lawson was pushing me to go to Cuba, and I said, we can't just go on vacation. My wife's not going to like that. We need a work reason, plus I want to write it off my taxes. So I've kind of got this idea for a travel economics book, but it's a different writing style than either one of us have ever done, where you all of a sudden you have to describe colors and smells and shit like that. And and I said, let's go to Cuba. We'll write it up and we'll test it out on some friends and see if they think we got something there. And if so, we'll map out the rest of the book. And then as we got favorable reactions to that, but as we started mapping out the rest of the book, it became not just a travel economics book. It got its focus, which was going to be socialism versus capitalism, partly driven by the countries that we were selecting that we thought were going to be interesting. But the other motivation, and this is now a little over 2 years ago that we started the project, was seeing the rising popularity of socialism in the United States, particularly among younger people, and thought that that would make a good theme that was necessary to address in a way that people who wouldn't read our academic journal articles or other writings might actually be interested in.
And so did you just sit down and like come up with a list of countries and then you hit them all? Or was there a thing where, you know, some of the countries it wouldn't work and so you had to change your list, or just how did that process happen?
Well, we started mapping out the list, and I guess there was some revision of dropping off originally some African countries that we were thinking of when we got the theme down to socialism, because in a lot of the African countries, even the ones that had nominally socialist identification, it was mostly Cold War politics, and they're places that have bad property rights and lack of freedom, but not the type of comprehensive planning and control of the economy that a real socialist system does. So I guess there was a little bit of revision in that, but otherwise we basically picked our lineup and did it, which was, and we did have to, and when we talk about Korea, we can talk about how we kind of skirted it a little bit with that one. But the list was Cuba, Korea, China, Ukraine, Russia, Georgia, and then the last chapter is back in the United States.
And so for some of those, it was the idea like Ukraine and Russia, the theme being that they used to be explicitly socialist and now they weren't? Is that the angle you took?
Yeah, because listen, I mean, the book would be really short if we only had the three real, because there's only three real socialist right. countries.
Well, yeah, let's take a minute to talk. I mean, because I've heard you give talks about the, you know, the manuscript before, so I kind of know where you're going with this, but I'm reminding myself the listeners might not realize. So yeah, that's probably a really critical thing for you to take a minute here and explain that, you know, what do you mean by the term socialism? And then in the world today, how many countries qualify for that?
Right. So we employ the strict economic definition of socialism, which means abolishing private property in the major means of production and replacing it with some form of collective ownership. Now, in practice, that collective ownership, anytime it's been on a large society-wide basis, effectively means state ownership and control. Now, with that in mind, I think of capitalism and socialism as two poles on the opposite ends of a spectrum, and no real world country is 100% socialist or 100% capitalist. Everybody falls somewhere in between. But to meaningfully call something socialist, you have to have either the collective ownership or at least the government control over the main commanding heights of your economy and making some attempt to plan how it's all going to run. With that in mind, the three remaining socialist countries in the world are Cuba, North Korea, and Venezuela. So just doing a book to three countries would have been a little bit too short. Mm-hmm. But we've got a whole bunch of other countries on the spectrum, which is one reason why we visit Sweden, which we call not socialism. We can talk about that in a few minutes if you like. But when it comes to like Russia and Ukraine, we call those hungover socialism. They used to be real socialist systems. They abandoned the socialist planning, of course, with the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. But they haven't made much progress towards economic freedom and towards the capitalist end of the spectrum. They're no longer centrally planned, but they're nowhere near free markets. And in fact, I think you could argue as we do in our chapter on China, which has a communist political party that is still the main political party, but they've reformed their system so much, it's now a crony capitalist system. It would be a mistake to call it a socialist system. They probably made, while leaving the communist in charge of the government, they probably made more real reform than the Soviet Union or Ukraine. And then Georgia was mixed in there, as Georgia was one that was once a formal socialist system, but has made radical reforms and now is one of the more economically free countries in the world.
So there it's gotten past the hangover, to continue that metaphor. Like they're clean and sober and they're fine. They don't even remember the drinking binge.
They're clean and sober, but they still got liver disease.
Okay. So,
but it's healing. And by that, I mean, Georgia is still very poor. Average incomes of $7,000 to $8,000 per capita. But of course, your standard of living, your income level, is something that compounds over time. So their reforms didn't start till the mid-2000s with the Rose Revolution. And since then, they've been growing rapidly. Their incomes are about a third higher than could be expected relative to when they started their reforms. They're growing well. It's just going to take time to heal that liver disease, if you will, and to get per capita incomes up at a high level. But they're healthy living now, if you want to say it that
way. Sure. Okay. Let me give you a minute here to respond, because obviously we want to dive into the specifics of these various places and, you know, get some of the local detail. But I can imagine a critic or a skeptic of your project saying something like this, that, oh, yeah, I'm sure, the countries you listed as actual socialism was North Korea, Cuba, and Venezuela. They're obviously basket cases economically. And then I bet, you know, since Sweden's doing well, he's going to say, oh, that's not real socialism. And so I could see someone alleging that you're just looking at the economic performance and then saying, well, because my dogma tells me free markets are good and socialism is bad, if a country is doing well economically, it can't be socialist. And so they would accuse you just of arguing in a circle like that. So what's your response to that?
That socialism means something particular, abolishing private property and the means of production and replacing it with state planning or collective ownership of some form. That is fundamental to all socialists in the past. Now, we can look at these countries and say, do they have that? And like I said, it is a spectrum. But in the world today, the ones that come the closest to getting rid of all private property and the major means of production would be North Korea, then Cuba, then Venezuela, probably in that order. Historically, the countries that came closest to it, I would say, was the Soviet Union in the period of war communism, which lasted until the early 1920s when they began switching to the new economic policy, and probably China under Mao during the Great Leap Forward. Both of those, after the absolute disasters, scaled back and allowed for more private control and autonomy to do a little bit better, but still remained way on the socialist end of the spectrum. In Sweden, it's just simply not the case that you have collective ownership or control of the means of production. They have widespread private property in all of the major factors of production. They have freedom to trade internationally, strong protection of private property rights, a rule of law that supports this. Bob's index, I think, does a good job of breaking this down. Lawson's index does a good job of breaking this down. When you look across all aspects of the economy, what Sweden has is a big welfare state and high taxes. You and I think there's a lot of problems with big welfare states and high taxes, but that does not equal collective ownership of the means of production. In fact, overall in this economic freedom index, Sweden ranks as the 27th freest economy in the world. Denmark, Norway, other Nordic countries that people mention like this also score very high in economic freedom. They're towards the capitalist end of the spectrum, not measuring economic performance, but objectively measuring economic freedoms.
Yeah, that's a great point. And just to underscore for the listeners, so this index that's public, is it called Economic Freedom of the World? Is that the actual title?
Yeah. Economic Freedom of the World Annual Report published by the Fraser Institute.
Yeah. And again, folks, this is BobMurphyShow.com/47. I'll put a link to, you know, their latest version. And I've participated in this, and I know the people at the Free Market Institute do a lot of research on this too, Ben. So folks, just so you realize, it's not arguing in a circle. Like, they have objective measures. You know, there's some discretion on the part of the analyst, like, to classify a country, but it's not looking at their GDP growth or something. I mean, it really is objective measures of economic freedom. And then they can do regression analysis and show that, hey, you know, you control for a bunch of obvious stuff and the country's economic freedom has a lot to do. It has a lot of explanatory power in terms of their growth or even more particularly the level of output per capita, that sort of thing. So it really is the case, you know, Ben, I'm sure you'd agree that there's a whole literature showing empirically, we're being real scientific like we're supposed to here, that economic freedom goes hand in hand with not just strong economic performance, but a whole host of other indicators of a good society, like, you know, literacy and survival rates of infants and things like that.
Sure. Pick almost any desirable socioeconomic outcome and you're going to find it correlates with greater economic freedom. maybe with some debate about equality of incomes. The literature is a little bit more mixed on that one. But overall, and I think this is an important point I want to emphasize that you brought up, the author, and I know both authors very well, they've been adamant for decades when they're doing this, that they're measuring economic freedom, period, not outcomes. Now, if outcomes come and correlate with it, that's fine. But across their five areas, they measure how big is the government, how much does it spend, what's the private ownership, how high are taxes? That's one area. Then security of property rights. Are property rights well-defined? Are the courts objective and do they enforce them? How sound is your money? Do you have low inflation? Do you have access to other currencies? How free are you to trade internationally? And finally, how regulated are you of both labor markets, businesses, and credit markets? That's what they're measuring, not outcomes. And when you measure those things in a place like Sweden, what you find is they have a big government, so they get dinged on that. And they have a lot of labor market regulations. They get dinged on that. But on all those other margins, Sweden is very capitalist. That's why it comes out 27th freest overall.
Yeah, and that's a fantastic point, just to make sure people get that, that using this objective measurement, you know, you can quibble folks with, you know, with the actual criteria, but the point is there are objective measurements. They're not just arguing in a circle. And then Sweden is the 27th freest country in the world, according to that ranking?
At least as of the writing of the book.
Right.
If the new rankings, sometimes these things move a little bit, but
yeah.
Sweden's always stable in the top, I don't know, 25, 30 in the index.
Just for a frame of reference, do you know, well, like, what's the freest one or two, and then where's the U.S. fall ballpark? I know you might not have it at your fingertips.
Freest in the world is Hong Kong, has been every year since 1970 when the earliest year they've ranked. Singapore is number two. Historically, the United States would sit in number three and occasionally number two, but that has not been true since 2000. The United States fell significantly from 2000 to the early teens, they ended up falling to close to 20 at one point. They've rebounded, and the United States, we're now, I think, in the top 10 again.
Okay. So that's great just to give people. So your point about Sweden would be, yeah, we're, you know, perhaps Sweden would be even better if they had lower, you know, less government spending or whatever. But certainly for American politicians or policy wonks or, you know, scribblers to hold up Sweden and say, oh, you guys told us that socialism was bad, but democratic socialism seems to work out just fine. Thank you very much. That's misleading.
It's not democratic socialism. It's almost as capitalist as the US of A. And also, by the way, the history of Sweden is that they used to be much more pro-market. In the 1900s, they made reforms that made them a very laissez-faire economy that grew rapidly until the 1950s. Then it started its slow transition, which by the 1970s was complete, to a big welfare state, high tax regime. And Sweden, which at one point was the wealthiest country in the world then, is now in the bottom half of OECD countries or rich countries. So basically the big welfare state and labor market regs slowed Sweden's growth rate. They didn't impoverish it. But as a result, it's not as dynamic and it's lagged behind more free market economies now.
So is it fair to say your overall conclusion or summary of Sweden is to say, yep, if you start out as a really laissez-faire place, you can grow rich and then you have the luxury of being able to afford a big welfare state, but then that's going to cramp your growth. So other countries that are freer are going to move ahead of you if that's the route your people decide to take?
Yeah, that's an accurate summary. And one of the other downsides then is when I buy beer there, Belgian beer that comes from not very far away is damn expensive because they tax the bejesus out of everything.
Sure. Okay, so now that we've gotten the official stuff out, make sure no one is misled by the narrative here in terms of the people claiming socialism. Do you want to proceed? I don't know. Are there like particular anecdotes that you think are very juicy for the listeners? Like, because obviously here you want to entice them to buy the book.
Yeah, I'd love for them to buy the book, Bob. What do you want to talk about? Anecdotes from which countries?
Well, why don't we start with Venezuela? So did you actually go inside or was that not allowed?
Yeah, no. Well, we went inside, but not legally, as in we didn't have a visa because we went across the land border from Colombia rather than flying into Caracas. Mm-hmm. And when we were there, we went into Cucuta, Colombia, and there's two bridges there that cross the river, and they've both been in the news a lot recently. That's where the aid trucks were stopped on the bridges and not allowed to come into the country. Mm-hmm. when we were there, it wasn't aid trucks, but the Venezuelans were free to cross the border into Colombia.
Do you remember the time period this was, just so people can place it?
The time of the year is easy because I had a bad New Year's hangover when I got on the plane. So it's just January 2nd, 2017, I believe, is when we went there.
Okay.
Yeah, January of 17. And at the time, many were crossing the border and migrating to Colombia. And in fact, millions of Venezuelans have left the country. But a lot of them were just crossing the border to buy basic necessities. And so this is an anecdote that's, you know, kind of was very striking when I witnessed it, because what you saw with the Venezuelans was not what I'd call typical third world poverty. I've been to plenty of poor countries and seen very poor places in them. Here, what you saw, the people crossing the bridge into Colombia, they were buying, basic toiletries, foodstuffs, things of everyday life. The economic system in Venezuela had so collapsed that it couldn't provide these things. But the people who were coming to buy it weren't the greatly impoverished Venezuelans, because they didn't have any resources to enter Colombia with to buy things. Instead, what you saw was people who were formerly middle class, upper middle class. In some cases, one couple we met took as much as 3 days to get to the border in order to buy stuff. So a 6-day grocery trip, basically. And the luggage that they were carrying was the type of luggage you'd expect to see in any major U.S. airport. This was, again, indicative of not normally impoverished people. And it's just such a tragedy of what we've seen in Venezuela, because some people might not appreciate this, but Venezuela was once relatively rich. If you go back to 1970, Venezuela was wealthier in per capita income than Spain itself. And Venezuela used to be relatively capitalist. That index that Bob does, if you go back to the 1970 ranking, Venezuela was in the top 10 in the world in terms of economic freedom. But what they had was a slow, long decline in economic freedom up until Chavez comes to power in 1998. And at that point, when he starts his Bolivarian socialism, that's when they take their huge decline in economic freedom and start setting them up for the disaster that's going on there today. But it's a warning sign of, no, this isn't just a poor country that didn't get rich. This is a place that was doing really relatively well. It stagnated by becoming statist, and then it collapsed by becoming socialist.
Okay, so that's good stuff, because I don't know how much you are aware of this, but in terms of some of the leftist progressive types in the United States, at least, once things were really bad with Venezuela and the shelves were empty and there were riots and things, Of course, American right-wingers were saying, aha, socialism doesn't work, USA, USA. And then the leftist types were saying, no, there's food on the shelves. That's just, propaganda and, from the U.S. military-industrial complex, and there's sanctions in play. So you're saying, at the very least, you saw with your own eyes, there really were people that couldn't get toilet paper in Venezuela.
Yes, absolutely. And I think in terms of the narrative, it's important, Bob, to remember, too, that it wasn't long ago that Venezuela was held up as successful democratic socialism, because Chavez, of course, came to power in 1998 being democratically elected. In the earlier 90s, he had tried a coup that failed. He got put in jail. He gets out of jail. He runs in what was deemed a fair election. There were international observers, including our own former president, Jimmy Carter, was there. It was democratically elected in 98, was reelected and put in a new constitution democratically. And Venezuela appeared to be doing okay, really, right up until about the time of Chavez's death in 2013. And in fact, when he died, Salon magazine ran an article called Hugo Chavez's Economic Miracle, and said that, any legacy-obsessed American president would love to have this economic record. The Michael Moores and the Sean Penns and the Hollywood types all praised Hugo Chavez and his successful democratic socialism. But what they were missing is that the actual socialist part of Venezuela was hollowing out the economy. The place was going to hell in a handbasket, but it wasn't obvious yet, because Venezuela sits on the world's largest oil reserves. When oil prices were very high, the Venezuelan government was selling oil, earning foreign exchange, and then importing things to give away. During the 2000s, food imports to Venezuela skyrocket, while domestic food production is collapsing because of the incentives created by a socialist system. That wasn't obvious in terms of the health and wealth of the people yet, because the government was subsidizing it with the oil revenue. But the government owned, Remember this, back to definition of socialism, state ownership or control of the means of production. The government-owned oil company doesn't do a good job of maintaining its equipment. Production numbers start going down, and then prices go down as well. And when that happens, the cloak is off, and it's revealed that the economy behind it all has been hollowed out, and things collapse. It's just the timing of it came right around the time, just a little after Hugo Chavez's death. But this was held up as successful democratic socialism. And note what's happened to the democratic part of that, as is necessary. And this is what I think young democratic socialists don't seem to get. The democratic part has gone away as the socialist economic system has collapsed. A socialist economic system implies that you have to have some sort of power to plan. When you have this power, you can exercise it over the people if they try to oppose you. So Maduro's recent, about a year ago, re-election with overwhelming support, when the population had on average lost 24 pounds that year. This does not pass the smell test. They didn't all of a sudden find Jenny Craig. The Venezuelans are having a hard time getting the calories to survive. And then as the president's overwhelmingly reelected, it's a scam of an election. If you work for the state companies, they were told that they had to vote for the president or they'd lose their jobs. They set up food aid stations next to polling places. They banned opposition candidates. They moved the timing of the election so others couldn't organize. And then more recently, the opposition-controlled National Assembly appointed an interim president, which they're allowed to do by their constitution. And Maduro and his thugs in the military have ignored it. So democratic socialism has become mere socialism in Venezuela.
Hey, folks, let's take a break from my discussion with Ben to talk about my book called Contra Krugman, in which I refute the errors of America's leading Keynesian. And so this book is a collection of the articles I've written over the years pushing back against Krugman on various topics, including environmentalism, you know, climate change stuff in particular, minimum wage, fiscal stimulus, monetary stimulus, the Great Depression, all sorts of stuff. It's good stuff, folks. So if you want to see that, go to ContraKrugmanBook.com. Each little piece is short and snappy. And by the time you're done, I think you're going to be surprised at how much I can use conventional economic statistics, the stuff that the U.S. government puts out, to show that Krugman's narrative often is at odds with the facts, despite his claims that reality has a well-known Keynesian bias. No, actually, reality has a well-known Austrian bias. So go to ContraKrugmanBook.com for more details on how you can order the book. Okay, so as far as the economic narrative, because, yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Oh, by the way, Joseph Stiglitz also early on was praising Hugo Chavez's, you know, economic policies. So, again, as you're saying, the narrative, like, these people on the right tutting socialism, but look at Hugo Chavez is proving them wrong. And then now it's, that's not real socialism, or they didn't do it right, or, you know, that's just due to the U.S. intervention. That's the problem. So you're the way you'd handle it is to say that Chavez, in a sense, got lucky that when he was moving them towards not merely just being economically unfree, but outright socialism, at least for a portion of his tenure, is when oil prices were rising pretty rapidly. And so that sort of masked the harm his policies were putting in place. But then once oil prices crashed, then, you know, that was, everyone could see quite clearly that there was a failure.
Yeah, and I'd say and we review this a little bit in the book in a more fun way, but related to the scholarship on this, your former colleague, Kevin Greer, co-authored a study, Cesar Chavez, that's pretty cool. They call it synthetic control. And basically what it does is it creates two Venezuelas, or it creates one Venezuela. There's the real Venezuela. And then what it does is it looks prior to Chavez's election. Let's take a weighted average of Latin American and OPEC countries that perform similarly to Venezuela, and tracks its real economic performance really closely right up till 98. And then let's look at what this kind of fake Venezuela and real Venezuela do subsequently. So even during those boom years when outside observers thought it was doing mostly good, what Kevin shows in his work is basically the Venezuela that got socialism relative to the fake Venezuela underperforms. Income should have been substantially higher than what they actually were under Chavez, just based off the performance of similar economies that also have access to oil revenue. So even during those good times, it was really underperforming relative to what it should.
Mm-hmm. And then going the other way too, it's, you know, people in Saudi Arabia weren't eating dogs and things like that, and they could find toilet paper once oil prices crashed, even though Saudi Arabia obviously is a major oil exporter. So the pro-socialists can't just say, well, you know, Venezuela got bad breaks because the oil prices collapsed. That didn't translate into such misery for other oil exporters.
Anywhere else. Listen, I teach at Texas Tech University, right, Bob? We're an hour and a half from the Permian Basin. Permian Basin didn't hollow out when oil prices went down in 2013-14.
Exactly. Okay, well, what about Cuba? Now, you guys were able to get in, because I know recently they changed the rules again, and now people can't go to Cuba, but you guys were able to get in, right?
Yeah, in fact, we, Bob, you and I and other academics can still get in, because if it's a research trip, it's all right, because the Cuban government's not the one prohibiting it, it's the United States government, which you're right, they did relax it for everybody. They allowed what they called like people-to-people aid, which basically means bring an extra roll of toilet paper to give to somebody, and then it's okay for you to go. But that is no longer the case under more recent rules. But Cuba, relative to Venezuela and certainly North Korea, is actually the best opportunity to just observe firsthand the workings of a socialist economy, because it is functioning socialism. It's not collapsing like Venezuela or the hell that North Korea is. And within Cuba itself, it's relatively safe. As long as you're not approaching and trying to talk to dissidents or talk about politics, you're going to be perfectly safe traveling about the country, and there's very little crime on tourists or things like that. So it's really an opportunity to just bang around and interact with a dysfunctional socialist economy more than you can anywhere else in the world today, probably.
And so you, as an economist walking around, I mean, I know, for example, when I was at NYU, there was a period where I was roommates with this girl who was a film major, and I'm pretty sure she was an actual Marxist. And she was so excited because she was going to get to go to Cuba. And I remember we had a brief conversation. And so I knew her going over there, any poverty that she saw, she was going to blame on the U.S. Embargo. You know, then that was there. So is it? I don't know how you would do that, but is there any way you can kind of try to disentangle that and say to, you know, American socialists, the problems with Cuba is not simply U.S. foreign policy?
Yeah. So there's lots of ways that we can cut this when you look at things. And really, as an economist, just banging around in Cuba is interesting, because what you have to try to separate is, when you see messed up outcomes, what is it that is just because Cuba is poor, and what is because Cuba is socialist? With the caveat, of course, that the main reason that Cuba is poor is because they're socialist, but there are plenty of poor non-socialist countries in the world. So separating out the oddities that come from being the planned socialist economy. And Cuba, there's a few different things that you can witness side by side that tell you that the messed up outcomes you're seeing have everything to do with central planning and government ownership and nothing to do with the U.S. embargo. So, for instance, staying in hotels. So remember, definition of socialism, government ownership or control of the means of production. Hotels, part of the means of production. Government owns all of the major hotels in Cuba. Now, you could go to the Hotel Nacional, the big diplomat hotel, and it's a five-star place and by all reports quite nice. But that's like the Soviets putting a cosmonaut on the moon. It's not representative of how the industry functions there. So, but we didn't want to sandbag it. We tried to stay in decent places. I'm not into unnecessary suffering. So first night we stayed in a three-star one, Hotel Trinton, in the western suburbs of Havana, on the beach. And it looks like, you know, it's a 1979 building. It looks like an old Soviet structure, you know, concrete and tall. As soon as you get there, the things that are wrong: 3 out of 4 elevators aren't working. The exterior of the building is hideously stained. Most of the windows on the upper floors are broken. You get to your room, the balcony's glass is broken. There's a missing panel in my bathroom. There's mold everywhere. Now, the price is relatively small. I think it was about $57, $60 a night, something like that. And the air conditioner worked, so that was a plus. Pool area, same thing. It was broken glass in the bar behind the pool bar. The pool had beer cans floating in it. It was all cloudy. It was a nasty hotel. But now here's where I say you get to do it side by side, is Cuba reformed laws to allow for limited private property, or at least limited private business, within people's apartments. Mm-hmm. So people who don't have the full property rights of being able to alienate and sell at market rates and stuff like that of the property itself, but they became allowed to rent. Initially, it was two rooms that they could rent. Now you can rent your whole apartment out. So they have these, they call them casa particular. And in fact, we arranged our first one via Airbnb, which is impressive since the internet is not widespread in Cuba and you can't use American credit cards in Cuba. But people who have relatives in Miami list apartments in Havana and other places in Cuba. And you make the payment to the relative in Miami who then calls their relative in Cuba and gives them the details for your stay and ultimately arranges to make some sort of transfer with them. So we stayed in one of those in central Havana, right near the waterfront. And it too was about $60 a night. But it was a two-bedroom place with a kitchen, a bathroom. Everything was meticulously maintained. It was in great shape. This is just the difference of incentives of private property versus collective ownership. And it wasn't a fluke just between these two places. We traveled to Trinidad on the south coast afterwards. And for $25 a night, had a wonderful casa. We make it back to Havana later. We stayed in, I think, Hotel Carib, which is right down from the central government building on the main boulevard. And, you know, it's back to they left you the last guest soap. There's a hole in your towel. The toilet seat's not bolted onto the toilet. This is just somebody makes a profit, so they give a shit because they want it, and they're going to take some of those profits and reinvest it to make more. Whereas state ownership doesn't give that type of incentives. The embargo does not explain why the same service with private property rights is done much better than when it's done with collective ownership.
So just to drive that home for the listeners, the issue is, and I'm trying to just make sure I get the narrative too. So obviously, we can see that the incentives must be involved there. But specifically, so is it that the hotel owners, is it just because it's so hard to open a new hotel that they have a quasi-monopoly? Or is it literally that the people running the official hotels, if they earn more and earn a profit, they don't get to keep it?
Yeah, the government is the owner of the hotels.
Okay.
It's not that they're a private monopoly. And you can see this, and I'll make it even briefer, but another industry, similar thing. Remember, state ownership or control of the means of production, state ownership of restaurants. Government owns lots of the restaurants, and it's god-awful, bland, crappy food. Private restaurants became legal a few years ago. And at first, they were limited in their seating capacity. I think they're up to 50 seats now that they can have. And originally, they couldn't serve beef or seafood, but now they can. And you can see the effort, just like in the casas, at the private restaurants who want to earn a profit, despite being heavily taxed too still. But even there, at first, and this is one of those things where it takes a little while to notice, at first the meals seem pretty good. But over the course of time, you realize each private restaurant has about the same, I don't know, dozen to 20 entrees. And they're all relatively bland. And it's because the state still controls the supply chain for food. So as a result, all the restaurants can only get the same ingredients and not a lot of variety for the flavors, so that Cuban food in Cuba is bland. Cuban food in Miami is delicious. Mm-hmm. But that's the economic system. That's not an embargo. And speaking of the embargo, maybe where it's most obvious of what's Cuban inflicted versus U.S. embargo is the automobile market. Everybody knows the stereotypical, you know, 1950s U.S. cars tooling around Havana, mm-hmm. Which, you know, at first it seems a little cute when you get in one for a cab ride for 15 minutes across Havana. But I'll tell you, driving across the island in one of those sucks. Going for a 6-hour drive or more, you have bumpy roads, lousy suspension in your car, no air conditioning, so windows are down, but you're windblown, hot, sweaty. Not a pleasant way to travel. And a lot of people will think, oh, well, yeah, they have 1950s cars because of the U.S. embargo. They can't get more cars. Except it's an embargo, not a blockade. There's nobody stopping Kias from coming into Cuba except for Cuba itself. What happens is the Cuban government severely rations the number of new cars that can come in. As a result, people use popsicle sticks and bubble gum to keep 1950s U.S. cars afloat. And it drives the price of them sky high. Most people inherit them. But when they're sold, now, keep in mind, per capita incomes in Cuba and all per capita income statistics in socialist countries are basically BS. But it's somewhere in the $2,000 to $3,000 probably per capita range. These 1950s cars, they sell for $15,000, $16,000. Meanwhile, other cars that we don't even use in the U.S. anymore, like a early 90s Peugeot or something like that, that might sell for $30,000 because it's got a better suspension and potentially even air conditioning. But that's self-inflicted Cuban quotas, not a U.S. embargo.
And just for people who don't know those terms, so the U.S. embargo means the U.S. government, you know, once Castro took over and everything, made it illegal for U.S. businesses to do business in Cuba. But they weren't like putting ships around and preventing other people from trading with them. So it's not like with what the U.S. government's doing to Iran right now.
Right. It's not preventing other countries from trading it. Cuba itself prevents other companies from engaging in private enterprise with Cubans in a way that would make them better off. Now, that said, Bob, and I suspect we're in agreement on this, I think the U.S. embargo on Cuba is a stupid idea. It's not the primary cause of Cuban suffering. It is a marginal contributor to it because absent that embargo, it's almost certain that the United States would be the biggest trading partner with Cuba, and that would do something to improve the lives of Cubans. But I also think it's political economy-wise a big mistake because it gives the regime in Cuba something to point to and blame their poverty on instead of pointing the finger at themselves for their own stupid policies. I think it's also the case that when you trade with a country more, it helps cross-pollinate ideas, and that greater trade and migration flows between Cuba and the United States would ultimately undermine the power of the regime there rather than isolating them the way the embargo does. In fact, there was one student there at the university. It was actually the best interaction I probably had with an individual while we were in Cuba. We're walking through the university and a student asked where we're from and we tell him the United States. And he immediately smiles and says, "Oh, I am so glad that people from the United States here now come, because when you come, you bring a little bit more." And Bob Lawson and I knew that the next thing he was going to say was money, which is fine. We wouldn't blame him if he did. But he said, "You bring a little bit more freedom." It was this idea that interacting with the United States would help bring freedom to Cuba, which is also, by the way, a ballsy thing for the kid to say. Mm-hmm. We were very careful in talking politics with people to not push them beyond your comfort level. But this one just freely blurted it out. I think his wisdom is greater than U.S. policymakers who put an embargo in place.
Sure. Yeah. And I do endorse everything you just said there, it's dumb. It's immoral because it's hurting, especially if the U.S. policymakers try to justify their sanctions by saying like, "Oh, there's some rogue regime out there and we want to, you know, support their people. And so we're going to penalize their bad government," when obviously the sanctions aren't hurting someone like Saddam Hussein. They're hurting the people. And like you say, that makes their population rally around them. I mean, the way you'd get a lot of people to support President Trump who don't right now is if somebody attacked the United States, you know, some outside group attacked the U.S., then all of a sudden people would rally behind the president. So that's and even just empirically, you can see, did the embargo, the U.S. embargo, get Castro out of power? It didn't seem like it worked, did it?
Yeah, this is how many decades of failed policy now? All it's doing is making regime change less likely, making Cubans a little bit poorer, and pissing me off because it's harder to get decent Cuban cigars.
You're right.
Which, by the way, another little story here on Cuba, their cigars aren't that much better than what you can get other places now. And it's because I think historically the Cuban cigars were, because the most talented rollers were also there. But the huge diaspora caused by socialism in Cuba moved talented cigar rollers to other places who have taught their skills to others. And now Nicaraguan, Honduran cigars are often of better quality in terms of assembly than what you get in Cuba. What's unique to Cuba is the soil and the particular weather where some of their tobacco is grown that give them a unique flavor. But quality control in terms of uneven burning and things like that, I think, is much worse in Cuba than it is in a lot of the other places.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. So speaking of vices, so part of the book involves drinking. So can you just talk about that? Like, is the theme there that you were drinking beers from different places and that was one indicator of the economic system?
Well, it's also the case that the way Bob and I travel is that we tend to drink a lot while we're doing it. But it also serves in the book as basically a metaphor. The beer or alcohol more generally is representative of how the economy functions. So I mentioned in Sweden, delicious Belgian beer was widely available, but very expensive because it was highly taxed. In fact, I had Belgian beer in South Korea on the opposite side of the world from where it's produced for a lower price than what I had it from right across the water in Sweden, basically. But that's capitalism still, just highly taxed. But when you get to Venezuela, Venezuela ran out of beer, or more particularly, the monopoly producer Polar ran out of foreign exchange because the government planners didn't allow them enough foreign exchange to import barley, which they need to make beer. As a result, the nation essentially ran out of beer. I don't know about you, but if I were a socialist dictator, like toilet paper and beer, I'd make sure always on hand. I'd screw up some other things, but those two would be my first priorities.
Just to keep the people happy.
Yeah. Cuba, there was no shortage of beer while we were there, but it illustrates the utter lack of variety that you get in socialist countries. So Cuba has two types of beer, Cristal and Bucanero. They're, I think, 4.5-5% alcohol. They're about 0.5% difference between them. They're both kind of like a skunky Budweiser. Not horrible, but not great. But there's no variety. There's no choices. And this is also striking if you walk into Cuban stores, even well-stocked ones, a convenience store, you might see 20, 25 distinct items, just lots of that same item. Socialism doesn't deliver on product variety. It just gives you sameness. North Korea, its god-awful swill. Imagine the worst malt beer you've ever had and then make it worse. Then if we want to talk about reform, the country of Georgia that was formerly socialist, they're great big wine producers. And in fact, the Soviet planners were commies, not idiots. They understood that Georgia being just east of the Black Sea was a better place to produce wine than, say, Siberia. But they mass produced swill there that was disgusting. And they did it on low-lying, fertile, easy-to-farm lands. Since reform there, the traditional Georgian winemaking industry has come back, and they make it in the hillier country with traditional Georgian winemaking methods and produce delicious and very unique wines, particularly the white wines. They press them with the skins and the stems all in there and store them in underground vats that they serve out of. And it's a more orangey color white wine. It's fantastic stuff now. But that's once they've gone back to a capitalist system. And then actually we found the irony after drinking the beers around the world at all these places. We went to the last chapter of the book's called Back in the USSA, and we attend the biggest socialist gathering in the United States at a conference in Chicago. And in the hotel knows their market. They have Revolution Brewing Company beer on tap, and it's got a tap handle that's green, but with a big commie red star on it. Mm-hmm. And little comrades were drinking it up. But the irony is that it's the largest privately owned brewery in the state of Illinois, but here that privately owned, it's a capitalist company. And this one capitalist company that puts commie logos on all of their products produces a greater variety and quality of beer than all of the socialist countries in the world.
I see. So very nice that, yeah, even capitalist firms are even better at being commie than commie firms are.
Yeah. In fact, another great irony, right, is Che Guevara's image is all put on commercialized onto all sorts of stuff now that the lefty buyers like to buy up and the capitalist producers are happy to provide for them.
Probably get free shipping from Amazon for their Che shirts. That's intriguing, that last chapter. Well actually, why can you mention North Korea? Like, so there, did you actually go into North Korea or not?
Yeah, no, we had to skirt around on North Korea. So promised the wives that we wouldn't get imprisoned or killed in the courses of writing this book. It's also the case, I mean, I direct the Free Market Institute.
Which is why married men live longer, because of stuff like that.
clearly, that's the causal mechanism. frankly, though, I mean, I'm skeptical that North Korea would have given either Lawson or I a visa anyway, given the institutes that we run. Mm-hmm. But the way we did North Korea then is the chapter's written up because it's a side-by-side comparison of you have a peninsula where you have the same history, culture, language, and in fact, level of economic development circa end of World War II. The North was probably wealthier than the South. Certainly more of its manufacturing, electricity, mining was all up there. And the main difference is that with the Korean War, you get one half of the country that's socialist and one half of the country that's capitalist. And of course, South Korea is one of the great economic success stories of the Asian Tigers that grows rapidly and now has first world status, you know, ballpark close to $40,000 per year, average incomes, long life expectancy, very great place. And the North remains impoverished under $3,000 per year of incomes to the extent you can measure these things. Millions of people starved in the 1990s. And it's totally a difference in the economic system. But to see it firsthand, I bet you a lot of your podcast viewers are the type of people who would have Googled, North Korean or Korean Peninsula satellite images at night, where you can see the South is lit up like a Christmas tree in the North, except for a little dot at the Capitol is all dark. And that's indicative of its economic development. Now, the way we did it, you can't really see it from the South Korean border because of the demilitarized zone. So we spent some time in South Korea, but then we went to Dandong, China, which is on the Yalu River on the border with North Korea on the north. And there, the main export city in North Korea was right across the river from us. But just like the satellite image at night, get into your hotel room at night and the Chinese side is lit up like a Christmas tree, and across the river, you can hardly see anything. It's black. But yet the next morning you wake up and you can see a city's over there that has about 300,000 people in it. So the satellite image that your listeners have probably seen is also what you'll see with your eyes on the ground there. And we traveled up and down the Yalu River a bit, checking out.
Ben, can I ask you on that? Is it because they literally don't have electricity, or just at night they don't provide it? Because you're all sleeping anyway. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, I think it's more the provision at night rather than not having any, period. Went up and down the river, and what's striking there, what's just completely unnatural to see, is this river that's only a couple hundred yards wide as you're going up and down. You look to one side and you see dilapidated, impoverished buildings, whether they're their commercial ones or the even more dismal, the residential ones. And then just across the river on the other side, you've got 30-story gleaming new high-rise buildings in China. These type of differences are not natural. These are caused by lines politicians draw on maps and adopt different systems. And China's system is no longer socialist, but it's still far from purely capitalist. It's a crony capitalist regime. But even that, relative to the socialism of North Korea, is just obviously so much more successful just to the naked eye going up and down a river.
Yeah, that is amazing, the contrast involved. So I'm curious, when you went for the last chapter where you went to this conference, did you say it was Chicago?
Yeah, fittingly.
Yeah. When you went to this conference in Chicago, was it mostly Americans there, or was it an international thing?
Overwhelmingly Americans under 35 years of age, probably, with a smattering of older Americans who would have been hippies from the 1960s, and not a heck of a lot in the age group in between.
Mm-hmm. And did you engage them in converse? Did they get a sense of where you were coming from, and you probed them to see how do they deal with this stuff, or were you mostly just letting them talk?
So I didn't argue with anybody there. I was there to learn, but I wasn't there to deceive anybody either. Bob and I would tell them that we're economics professors working on a book on socialism. And then we sat in their formal sessions to hear what their speakers said. But then we, not surprisingly, would go to the bar and drink and go up to the young people there and ask them their thoughts, what attracted them to the conference, how do they identify with socialism, and to explain some of these anomalies of other things we've seen. And overwhelmingly, what I got is that for a huge percentage of them, they're using the label socialist without identifying with the essential feature of socialism of abolishing private property and replacing it with a form of collective ownership. Instead, it's environmentalism, abortion, some other issue where they just are far to the left of the mainstream Democratic Party and say that socialism is the answer to that without understanding what socialism really is. For some of them, they're big welfare state Nordic model type people who mistakenly think that's socialism. But then for a significant chunk, they identify as socialist in the way that we're using the term here. And for them, what they'll say is, though, they are democratic socialist, or they want socialism from below, which is an even more extreme version. The socialism from below, they'll say none of these countries that we have labeled as socialist, either currently or historically, like the Soviet Union, is the type of socialism they want. Because theirs is going to come from below. These other things they'll say was either state socialism that was totalitarian, or they'll call it state capitalist regimes, which I find particularly obnoxious. But instead, their version with socialism from below, where the workers will just decide what to produce. And what they seem to miss here is that every socialist regime ends up centrally planned because you have to coordinate economic activity. You and I know in markets, prices and profit and loss coordinate economic activity. They make producers adjust based on the needs of others. if workers are just deciding from below what to produce, but we're not going to use prices and profit and loss to punish and reward people for making good decisions, somehow you have to coordinate. Otherwise, you're making 15-inch tires at the tire plant and the trucks are making 35-inch wheels and you're not coordinated. So these systems become centrally planned. And with that comes, like we talked about with Venezuela, the loss of democratic freedoms eventually as well. They seem to miss the necessary connection between this. And I suppose this forms of collective ownership with kind of production from below, but these tend to be like the kibbutz or the isolated community, but living in a sea of capitalism otherwise, and even still have tremendous incentive problems for production within them. But they're not capable of advanced material production in a diversified economy. Your commune's not going to make an iPhone, comrade.
Right. So I definitely see that. I'm curious, were the speakers, or at least some of them, pretty highbrow? And, you know, you felt like, oh, yes, this person understands like the calculus. Where I'm coming from is, I know when I was in grad school, I dabbled a little bit with the anarcho-socialists. And some of them, like, they were fully aware of Mises' calculation objection and they had a response and, you know, going back. So some of them were very well educated in the new economics. It's just they were coming from such a different starting point that, you know, it was hard for us to find any common ground. Did you see that at least among the speakers, or were they really just out of touch?
Among the speakers, there were some that I thought did a pretty, like the speaker on Venezuela, did a pretty good job of describing all of the problems in the Venezuelan system and what was going on. So it wasn't like that they were just nuts. But then, like, you know, 2/3 of the way through the speech, she starts denouncing the state capitalist regime of Venezuela. And what I got from all of these people is, they are going to define their version of socialism as one that has never existed before, one that I think for theoretical reasons can't exist. But then they're going to distance themselves from every regime that has eliminated private property and replaced it with some form of collective ownership as not their version. And I guess I'm sympathetic in that socialism and capitalism in their pure forms are two poles on the opposite end of the spectrum. And all these real world countries fall somewhere on that spectrum. But, you know, Bob, you and I are capitalists in a way that's more pro-capitalism than Hong Kong that comes out of the top of that economic freedom index. But what I'm willing to still bite the bullet and do is say those regimes that come the closest to my version of private ownership or means of production and private control, they do pretty good. What the socialists all want to do is say all the regimes that are closest to collective ownership and anti-private property have nothing to do with their system because it's not 100% their system and they're not willing to own it.
Well, that's great. Yeah, you just anticipated the devil's advocate question I was going to bring up, because you do hear among, it's such that it's become like a cliche or something that's often used against them, is I've seen people say, oh, no true free market, like mocking the libertarian response, that whenever someone points to the abuses under like the George W. Bush administration or something like that, the, you know, Rothbardian anarcho-capitalists will say, oh, well, that's not really capitalism. And so you can see how the socialist, or even just the, you know, interventionist, someone like Paul Krugman or something, could laugh and say, ah, you free marketeer, you're holding up this ideal of pure unvarnished capitalism where the big government doesn't get in bed with big business, because that's not what I support. I don't support cronyism. Well, in practice, that's always going to happen, you idiots. And so I liked your response, though.
Yeah, and it's relevant for a lot of the young people that I met at the socialist conference too. Because a lot of the things that they were identifying of U.S. imperialism, U.S. immigration restrictions, the abuses by police, a lot of these things are that I'm pretty sympathetic with and agree with. And I'd say, yeah, my version of capitalism would reform a lot of these things. But I'm still willing to say those countries that are closest to my vision of capitalism overall are pretty good places and are a lot better than the places that are farther away from it, while still recognizing these problems and advocating for greater reforms towards a freer market that would address them. And I think that's something that needs to be better communicated to young socialists, is that a lot of the problems they identify are legitimate, but socialism's not the answer to solve them. Greater freedom is. And certainly, like, work I've done on immigration over the years is consistent with this. And to me, it's absolutely stunning that people who identify with wanting greater immigration say socialism's the answer, because socialist countries build up walls to keep in their own people and usually strictly limit the entry of others as well.
Oh, that's I mean, are they doing that just because they don't want outsiders coming in and seeing how bad the system? I mean, I couldn't imagine there were a lot of people wanting to immigrate into North Korea, for example.
Well, that's the other thing. Not a lot of, if you look at where people migrate, in the literature using economic freedom on this, freedom is a magnet. The more free a country, it's the more people are going to want to come into it. The less free the country, the less that are going to come on into it. So I guess, ironically, you could solve your immigration crisis in the United States by adopting socialism and becoming such a miserable place that nobody wants to come here.
Exactly. Okay, Ben, well, speaking of immigration, so here, why don't we just, is there any particular piece, because I know that's one of your areas as well, but that's sort of an entirely different discussion, but is there something for somebody who's generally a fan of free markets, but thinks, oh man, you know, that's this claim of having relatively open borders or whatever, that would just swamp the U.S. system and, you know, it would ruin things, so we got to really be tight on the borders. I know you disagree with that judgment, and so is there something we can link to that gives your side of the story on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a pro-immigration guy as a pro-capitalist guy. These are economic acts between consenting adults across a line some politicians drew on a map, and I don't know why I would stop them from interacting. Where I deal, I did a book called The Economics of Immigration. You can find it on Amazon, and it's written for normal people. It doesn't have the drinking and the cursing that the Socialism Sucks book does, but it is written for normal people. And basically, the first half of it goes through the social science findings on various fears about what immigration would do to destination countries. And then the second half of the book debates what the appropriate policy regime is in light of that. That book's available and out there now. And then currently I'm working on a new book on immigration, but it's not going to be out for a while yet. That deals with, I think, the best objection to immigration is, what if immigrants are coming from poorer, less free countries? If they bring some of those values with them, might they undermine the very freedoms that make us prosperous here? And I'd say that the evidence I'm finding so far on this is no. And in fact, quite often they'll improve your institutions. And I think a large part of the reason is both assimilation of the immigrants' values, and the immigrants who come are not representative of the immigrants' origin countries generally. The Cubans coming to Miami do not want socialism in the United States. And I think there's an element of that in other forms of immigrants as well.
Okay, very interesting. Yeah, so I will link to your immigration books. Remember, folks, BobMurphyShow.com/47 is where you'll get all these links. The book that's coming out just today as this podcast is released is Socialism Sucks. We've been talking with Ben Powell. And Ben, nice talking to you, and success on your book.
Thanks very much, Bob.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit BobMurphyShow.com.